Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald, is free on Amazon.com. Seeing the future comes at a price. What price would you be willing to pay to save thousands of lives? Mark Taylor knows his actions scream guilty, but he was only trying to stop the horrible terrorist attack. Instead of a thank you, the government labels him an enemy combatant and throws him in the brig with no rights, no trial, and no way to prove his innocence. He learns firsthand that the CIA can do anything they want to him, anything at all. Mark's just a regular guy, a photographer, who finds himself in an extraordinary situation when an antique camera he buys at a dusty Afghanistan bazaar produces photographs of future tragedies, tragedies he's driven to prevent. His frantic warnings about September 11th are ignored, but put him in the government crosshairs when he learns what being labeled an enemy combatant really means. Download this intense and gripping thriller now, free on Amazon. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, book one by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters, that's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. picoshouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretends she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Mark Kenyon as my guest on the show. Mark has an amazing new book. It's called That Wild Country, an epic journey through the past, present, and future of America's public lands. Mark, thank you so much for joining me today. I love the book, and I can't wait to see where our conversation goes today.
Thank you so much, Hank. I'm excited to be here and appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
Absolutely. Mark, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
That's a great question. And I think that it would have to be back in fourth grade. I had a social studies teacher who each week on Monday morning, you would come in and everybody would be asked to volunteer to tell about your weekend. And I guess I was that brown-nosing child who every weekend or every Monday, I had my hand up high wanting to tell everybody my story. I always want to tell my story. And so inevitably, 97% of the class was groaning and they didn't want to tell their story. And so Mr. Kendra would be anyone, anyone, anyone. And I had my hand up in the back, kind of like Hermione Granger and Harry Potter, that kind of thing. Like, I got a story. I got a story. And so I told my story every Monday. And that's an early memory I remember of just wanting to tell stories, wanting to share my experience, just getting a kick out of sharing. And so that was the storytelling aspect. When it came to writing, that didn't percolate, I guess, for me until later in my years. I loved to read my entire life. I've been a bookworm. My parents always joke that when I was 8 or 9, I read Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park, and they thought that was pretty surprising that an 8-year-old would read that and understand it and enjoy it. And that's just kind of been me my whole life. I've just devoured every piece of writing I possibly could, still do to this day. And so that, as it is for many people, translated to me wanting to someday see if I could evoke that same power or that same, the gift that books were to me. I want to someday try to give that gift to other people. And in high school, I kind of dabbled with the idea of trying to write about sports. I was really into sports at the time, so I thought maybe I could be a sport writer and write for the Detroit Press or something like that. And then, two decades later, that slowly moved to me realizing that maybe instead I would write about my true passion, which has kind of guided my life through adulthood, which is the outdoors, hunting, fishing, camping, backpacking, the environment, conservation. Those things are what my life really is centered on, and that seemed to be a natural place for me to try to share something through my words, and that's what led me to writing That Wild Country.
I love it. That experience in the fourth grade where you were the kid that always had a story to share, what was your teacher's response to that, and did you ever get feedback from an adult, maybe that teacher, maybe a different one, maybe a parent who saw this love of story in you and encourage that along the way?
You know, I don't think that teacher necessarily, he was always fine with it. He let me tell my stories. But I did have, and this might be a pretty cliche answer, but I did have an English teacher at one point who told me that I shouldn't ignore what I had there. I guess I was a half decent writer at that point for a 9th grader, 10th grader, whatever it was. And so she definitely encouraged me. And I suppose whether I realized it at the time, maybe instilled in me some confidence that has helped me progress. But it really was later in life. It wasn't until I was in the real world, I guess you want to call it, when I realized that maybe I do have something that's worth taking seriously and sharing more consistently. I it took me a while to figure that out. I was a little bit of a late bloomer when it came to writing. For a long time, I thought I was going to go into business, and I dabbled there and then realized that having a life of meaning, doing something that you're really passionate about, was going to be a lot more important to me than, you know, the big paycheck or the fancy job that when I was 15 or 17, I thought was important. I quickly realized that that wasn't what was going to keep me fulfilled through life. So that's sort of where things took me.
Gotcha. Where did you grow up? Where do you call home?
I grew up on the west side of Michigan, in a city called Grand Rapids. Okay. And now I live in the south central part of the state in a more rural portion of Michigan.
Gotcha. I grew up in the deep south, down in South Mississippi, down toward the Gulf Coast. And I have a good friend, Paul, who grew up in the Upper Peninsula. And,
oh, yeah.
And,
the UP.
The UP, yeah, as he calls it. And, what really struck me is, through the years and all of our conversations we have, a lot of our upbringing was very similar. And, you know, the outdoors, we both spent a lot of time outdoors and hunting and fishing and hiking and camping and all the stuff that we did with our families. And even though we were separated by hundreds and hundreds of miles, you know, there's not a lot, climate's different, obviously, but you know, the way we interacted with the place around us was very similar. What was it about growing up there and in that kind of environment, do you think that you've carried with you, through all of your life experiences?
Everything. My early childhood introduction to the outdoors, established this foundational love that has guided almost every important decision I've made in the last 15 years. From an early age, I was blessed to have a father and a grandfather who were really involved in my life. And from the time I was three or four, were taking me up to we had a little cabin up north, 40 acres and surrounded by public land all around it. And I was able to go up there and spend time with the adults, and they took me into the swamp and let me tromp through the muck and step over stumps and climb over trees and try to learn how to navigate your way through what seemed like a massive, very wild wilderness at the time, and allowed me to just explore and be a little kid and get dirty and take some risks and learn to appreciate the sound of the wind through the trees or watching a raccoon walk across the forest floor, all those little things that a lot of kids that I grew up with, because we lived in the second largest city in Michigan, a lot of my fellow classmates didn't have that kind of family. They didn't go to these places. They never knew that. They never saw that side of what's out there. And I was just very lucky to have a family that did. And so ever since then, I've just had this really strong appreciation for the outdoors and need for it. I absolutely crave being able to get outside and get away from the noise and the hustle and bustle. If I don't have that frequently, I become I feel claustrophobic. I feel just like there's a big hole in you and you have to fill that hole. And for me, the hole is filled with wild places and wild animals. And I'm just thankful that here in America, we have a lot of both.
Right. What would you say, growing up in the second largest city, like you talked about, a lot of the other kids didn't have the same experiences as you. And I'm sure going through life, you've had some interesting career opportunities, it sounds like. And I know there, you know, even in the rural South, there are people that never get outside of their four walls and go explore the world around them. And there are a lot of misconceptions. There are a lot of opinions that people form that don't always hold to be true. What do you think are some of the big misconceptions that people have about outdoorsy type people, or maybe people that enjoy the outdoor sports, hunting and fishing and things like that? What do you think people get these ideas in their head that sort of solidify that just aren't true about people that enjoy the outdoors?
Yeah, well, there certainly is a lot of that. And I suppose the same could be said for any different subgroup out there, right?
Of course.
Just natural human nature that people develop assumptions or stereotypes based off of something they say in the media or something they saw on social media, or a one-time interaction they had. If you don't have a personal connection or frequent exposure to a group of people, we'll say hunters or anglers or outdoorsmen and women, you're just going to have to cherry pick your idea from that little exposure you did have. Maybe it was watching Bambi as a kid, or maybe it was seeing a news story on CNN about someone who killed a lion in Africa. And then that forms your opinion of that entire group of people. And just as it is with every other culture or subgroup, unfortunately, it's oftentimes misguided, or you're seeing just a single bad apple, or you're cherry picking one tiny thing that is not actually true of 99.99% of that group. And so, unfortunately, a lot of people look at, in particular, like the hunting and fishing community, as folks who are bloodthirsty, who are ignorant, who are rednecks, who are disrespectful to the environment. There's a lot of that kind of thing out there, which is a shame, because that is not the truth of the matter for 99.99% of that community. Of course, there are bad apples, just like there are bad apples in the tech community, and there are bad apples in the Michigan State Spartan fan community, and any community, fine, right? There's going to be a few bad apples. And so, unfortunately, that sometimes paints the larger group in a bad light. So the truth of the matter is, though, for a lot of people who love hunting and fishing, they share the exact same love and passion that someone who likes to camp or birdwatch or backpack or climb has. They share that same passion for nature and for the wilderness and for the forest and for clean air and clean water. We just go about engaging with it in a different way, but in a very deep and meaningful way that is just hard to understand unless you've been a part of it. So I worked, previous to what I do now, I worked for Google, and that put me in close contact with folks from a very different background than me. So every day I was working with people who went to Harvard or Yale, and they grew up in LA or New York City or Boston. And I am a hunter. And so they found me to be a very, I guess I was just unique. And so a lot of people had questions. Everyone's like, you do what? What do you do in your spare time? What did you do growing up? Your dad took you to do this? I was fortunate, though, to, even though these people had no context, and maybe they did have some assumptions based off things they'd seen in the past, almost to every single person I spoke with while there for 4 years working at Google, they were all really open and curious. They wanted to hear it straight from the horse's mouth. What is it really like? What is it like to backpack into a wilderness and spend 7 days out there? What is it like to acquire your food yourself and to hunt an animal and feed your family in that way? Why do you do it? How do you do it? What does it actually look like? People in many cases were genuinely surprised to find out that this stuff is really carefully managed to be sustainable, to be respectful to wildlife populations. People were genuinely surprised to find out that this meat is incredibly healthy, and it's done in a way that can promote the future of these species and protect the landscapes. People were genuinely surprised to find out that, you know, hunters aren't bloodthirsty people that just want to shoot things. They are going about this in a very careful, meaningful way, feeding their families, having a special interaction with the wild landscape that they're visiting. And so I came out of that period of my life realizing that there's a information gap there between, I'm going to overgeneralize here, but what we could say between the urban and rural communities, there's an information gap there, there's an experience gap, and it's really important to try to help bridge that by being a positive representative of the communities I'm a part of, and being really open and willing to talk with people differently from me and share my experience with them, and also try to understand their experience. And so that's what I've tried to do subsequently through my work, is try to share my story in a way that people can understand and relate to and learn from. And with this book in particular, I thought this is especially important now, because I think the future of what we have here in America, which is an incredible public land system, the future of all these places really depends on many different groups of people that are seemingly different coming together to stand up for these places.
So you're working at Google and you're having these conversations with people and hopefully gaining some understanding with folks. What prompted you to start trying your hand at outdoor writing, and what brought you to this grand adventure that we read about in That Wild Country?
Well, it started simply with kind of, as I talked about a tiny bit ago, the fact that I originally thought I wanted to get into business. I had an internship in New York City with a large advertising agency, and my job there was to connect with bloggers and connect our clients with those bloggers and get them to write about their products. So during this phase, I'm 20, 21 years old, and I realized, wow, there's people writing online about things they're passionate about, and they're making a living doing that. Maybe I could do that. And I was in Manhattan, and I couldn't get outside and go to the places that I love so much. I couldn't hunt. I couldn't fish. I couldn't go hiking. And I was going stir crazy. I was going nuts. And I had this epiphany one day that maybe I could do this whole blogging thing. So that's where I got started. I started a website writing about my passions and just slowly but surely started expanding from there. I realized, wow, this is a lot of fun to write about these things I love. Maybe I could take it to another level. And so eventually was able to write for a number of outdoor publications, magazines. And then eventually that expanded and continued to be able to eventually go full-time as an outdoor writer and podcaster within the hunting and fishing community. From there, spending a tremendous amount of time outside and exploring public lands over the last decade or so, my wife and I have been really fortunate to be able to have very flexible careers as far as where we work. So I can work from anywhere, and my wife was able to work out a deal at her job where she could work from just about anywhere. She could work remotely, and that led to us being able to spend months at a time traveling and living on the road. So we were spending 2 to 4 months a year living out in Wyoming and Idaho and Montana. First, we were renting little cabins and camping out on the weekends. And then eventually we bought an old camper and renovated that and actually lived in campgrounds on public lands for months at a time. And kind of parallel to all that, there was also this rising controversy around public lands that was increasingly threatening the future of our national forests and wilderness areas and a whole slew of really special places here in America. And so I was out there engaged with these places. I was learning more and more about how threatened they were. And I had this latent love of reading and writing, and I was sharing those types of things on a smaller scale. I eventually realized there's a bigger story here, and there's a bigger information gap here. A lot of people don't realize what we have, what's at stake, what's threatening it, and how we got here. And all of that led me to eventually realizing this is a story I can tell from a perspective of someone who is just learning about these things himself and loves them a lot. And maybe that's a relatable and compelling story, which eventually became That Wild Country.
So the story came about from your kind of inside experience at the time. You're living at these places for periods of time, you know, enjoying them, and then seeing the controversy that's kind of boiling around that. So instead of dreaming up this topic, I'd like to write about this, this actually came from the experiences you were having.
Yeah, exactly. It was happening all around me. I was learning about it as it was happening. And I realized there's a need to go deeper. There's a need to understand the context. How did we get here? And that inspired me to really dive deep into the research and the history of our public lands in America and then weave in my own experiences on the ground exploring them, which is the book.
So, right. And before we get into that history of where these public lands come from and why they're so important to us, you open the book with – you know, with the stories of you and your wife are traveling, but this Bundy situation was unfolding, and you kind of opened the book with that, and realized starting to kind of see how this public land debate was coming to a very real head. with, you know, people that were, you know, going to get hurt over this thing. What was that situation that was happening, and what was your reaction to it?
So some people might remember in 2016, a group of folks occupied and took over a national wildlife refuge in Oregon. It's the Male Heuer National Wildlife Refuge. Essentially, this is a large piece of public land that's managed for waterfowl and wildlife. And this group of people, led by a gentleman named Eamon Bundy, went in there and took it over and basically said, hey, we are going to stay here, and we are well armed and, you know, not afraid to do whatever we want to do to stay here until a series of demands are met, or at least listened to. And they basically were, to oversimplify this a little bit, they were upset with how some ranchers had been prosecuted and eventually incarcerated for some things they'd done on public land. They thought that was not fair. And they also thought it was not fair or right or okay that America has federal public lands. The Bundys have had a long history. This is a family out of Nevada. They had now traveled to Oregon. They have a long history of having a pretty strong anti-federal government stance, not recognizing the federal government's ownership of land and management of land. So they were here to make a statement about that and try to raise a ruckus and get a bunch of media attention around it. And they achieved that. They did get a lot of media attention because there was a group of armed men and women taking over a federal facility. That's a pretty big deal and a dangerous situation. But the larger message that they were trying to promote and raise a fury around was this idea that, in their belief, America should not have public lands. Instead, these lands should be given or sold off to private landowners. My belief, and the belief of many, many others in this country, is that, number one, and this isn't a belief, this is simply a fact, the Constitution allows us to, the federal government, to own land, to manage land. This has been handled in court time and time again. But the greater issue here is that federal public lands serve a tremendous purpose in this country. They drive tremendous economic gain. They provide a very important refuge for wildlife, for clean water in this country, carbon. What's the word I'm looking for here? I'm blanking here, Hank. But there are so many different environmental services that our 640 some million acres of public land serve, let alone recreation and what people can gain from going in these places and hiking or fishing or camping or taking their child to Yellowstone and seeing a buffalo for the first time or rafting down the Grand Canyon. These are things that change people's lives. These are things that you remember from when you were 10 years old. When you're 50, you're still telling the story about that trip you took. These are really special things that we have here in America that a lot of other folks across the world do not have. And so to hear Eamon Bundy and his like trying to say, like, oh, no, that's not important, we should instead give these lands to private landowners and they should just be able to do whatever they can do, that was kind of like an affront to my religion. And unfortunately, there's a certain subsegment of politicians who were on board with that and who took advantage of this media hype to say, yeah, we shouldn't have public lands. We should sell them off. We should milk as much money as we can get out of these places. And in my opinion, that's a misguided approach and a dangerous idea.
Well, it's, and I don't like to talk about politics on the show, but I think this is apropos. This is where politics gets weird around certain situations and where you think that lines are clearly drawn. Public lands is one of those topics that defies logic when it comes to talking about politics, because a lot of people that use public lands are outdoorsmen and hunters and fishers and anglers and all of those types of people, which tend to be on the conservative side of the mm-hmm. spectrum. Not always, but you know, tend yeah. to be. And they enjoy this, thing that some people consider kind of a liberal concoction, the public lands and the federalizing of land. And it, you know, the lines get really blurry and weird, in there. Looking at this, have you seen, kind of the way that politics is affecting this, and what can we do about it to talk some sense into our representatives and the people that have the ability to make change?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a real shame that public lands have become a partisan issue, and that you see, as you kind of alluded to, generally recently the Republican Party has been rather antagonistic towards public lands and has been the party that has been promoting this idea of transferring or selling public lands, while the Democratic Party has been much more in favor of protecting them, protecting that environment, et cetera, et cetera. As you stated, a lot of conservative Republican voting folks do enjoy and benefit greatly from these public lands, just as many Democratic voting folks do. What's interesting, though, is that it wasn't always that way. It wasn't always a partisan issue. Interestingly, Theodore Roosevelt, who was, I don't think it can even be argued, I think it's simply fact that he was the most influential, most important person when it comes to us having public lands and thriving wildlife populations and wild spaces across the country. He set aside more than 200 some million acres of national forests and other public lands, was instrumental in the protection of places like the Grand Canyon, like Olympic National Park. If you read the book, it's crazy how many different things he had a hand in. He was a Republican. And as you continue down the line, you see bipartisan support for many public land issues in this 50s and 60s and 70s as well. It wasn't really until there were some back and forth throughout, but it wasn't really until you get into the 80s that it became this fiercely partisan issue, where you then have this administration by administration swing, like a pendulum of swinging from right to left, from right to left, that dramatically impacted public lands. And so we're seeing that again today. During the Obama administration, there were a number of things that were generally positive for public lands. And now with the Trump administration, there's certain things now that are generally negative for public lands. And I think that is discouraging. And I think it is, though, something that is – this partisan divide is symptomatic of a larger issue in our country, probably. I think we're just seeing this hyper-partisan tribalism, right? I think that's one way we can talk about it. And the country, it sometimes seems, getting like torn apart at the seams. And public lands are a unique opportunity for unification, I think. Because while our politicians are split to a degree, Republicans and Democrats on public lands, our actual citizenship, the actual people in America, are not. Public lands are incredibly well supported across party lines. People love them. People benefit from them. They are uniquely American and special to Americans, both Republicans and Democrats. So we have this really great opportunity to come together on something, which just doesn't happen as much as you wish you would see. But we have that chance now here. And I think it can almost serve as a shining light of what Americans can do when they set aside petty differences and they set aside, you know, whether they have a D or an R next to their name, and instead they say, hey, this thing actually really matters. And maybe we don't see eye to eye on everything about it, but the basic fundamental truth of the matter that, hey, we want to keep these places around and we want to keep them healthy and accessible. If we can agree on some of these foundational things and work together there, That's a great stepping stone towards bringing our nation back together, I think. And so when that happens, it does make a difference. There was an example I share in the book about a proposal a couple years ago from a Republican representative to sell off a large slate of public lands, 3-some million acres of land he proposed to sell off. And enough hubbub was raised between both Democrats and Republicans, hunters and climbers and campers, wildlife watchers and anglers, across the whole suite of folks, we were able to raise enough of a ruckus that this representative, within a week's time, had to publicly declare that he was going to rescind that bill and say, hey, whoa, I was wrong, I guess. I'm sorry. The fact that we could have that kind of power, that immediate of an impact, I think serves as an example of what we can do when we come together. So that's something that I really hope folks can take from this book is it's not an accident we have these places. There's a lot of people, a lot of men and women who fought really hard so that we have Yellowstone National Park and the Bob Marshall Wilderness and all these incredible places across the country. There's a lot that went into it. And secondly, if we want to keep it around, a lot's going to be demanded, and that's going to have to come from us standing up, working together to keep them here.
Right. The book that you could have written could have been how do I say this? It could have been a scholarly tome that said a lot, but that no one would read. I think we've seen lots of books like that conveys a lot of information, but not in a way that's going to engage a large crowd. The way you wrote this book is through your own eyes and your own experiences, and you tell these great stories of you and your wife kind of exploring the world and all of this stuff, and we get to go on a journey with you, not have you lecture to us about the importance of this thing and why these things matter and all that. You know, what happens in a book like this is you begin to change hearts that then can begin to change minds. What was the motivation to write this book this way? And at what point did you start realizing this was a book, and how did it start unfolding for you?
So Hank, you nailed exactly what I was hoping to achieve with this book, which was make it readable by the average person. There are other resources out there, other books, papers, whatever it might be, that covers the history of public lands or conservation or biographies of these people. But your average guy or girl probably isn't going to wade through all of that minutia. They're very detailed, scholarly, you might say. I wanted something that anyone could pick up and enjoy, because I've always thought that it's hard to get people to eat their vegetables, but if you give them some candy along the way, they're much more apt to eat a good meal. And so my thought process here was tell a good story, tell an engaging story, share your experiences, why you love these places, and along the way, slip in some of this information that hopefully will educate and inform people and intrigue them to learn more. And so that's what I wanted to do. And I tried to do that. I feel like even now, I'm not sure how many other authors are, but even still now, the book's out there to the world. I still think, oh, I wish I'd done this a little differently. I wish I'd done a better job of that, or I wish I had changed this, or I wish I had flip-flopped this, or whatever. I'm constantly critiquing it and thinking of ways I could do it differently next time. But it's a relief and a thrill to hear from you that you thought it achieved that. And I do think it's important for these issues and this information isn't helpful to anyone if no one actually reads it. So I would rather share less detailed information if I know someone can actually get through it and process it. If you can get a couple key points through by way of having a lot of other, I don't want to call it fluff, but more engaging content around it, I think that's a lot more important than having nobody want to pick up the book in the first place or get into the first few pages and be overwhelmed. So for me, these are the kinds of books that I enjoy the most. These are the books that I read the most and take the most from. So it only seemed natural to try to create something like that myself.
Well, and the book is fun. You know, it's you do cover some heavy topics, and we get a good dose of history in there, but not overbearing history. I think you give what you did for me was pique my interest to go do some heavy digging on my own. This book doesn't try to be all of that, but it gives you enough that you can do well informed research. Yeah. Let me just put it that way. You know, it's definitely steers you in the right direction. And I love your writing style. You share these personal experiences. Sometimes it's a little self-deprecating, and which I love. I love someone that's confident enough to, kind of let its guard down a little bit. And we really see your humanity through this, which I think is an important part when we're talking about a topic like this. It's something that connects our humanity. How long did it take you to write this book?
Oof. Well, the process began years and years ago with the whole idea coming together. I think it was around 2016 when I finally decided, okay, this is a book. Maybe late 2015, early 2016, I realized I could try to form this into a book. And then there's this whole book proposal process and trying to get a book deal and all those things. That took some time. But I think actual writing, it was about a year and a half, somewhere in that ballpark, about a year, I guess, of the actual writing part. But the trips and the note-taking during the trips and the research and studying, that was going on for, 3 years probably. I pulled from a lot of those experiences that had basically been going on from 2015 through 2018. That chunk of time was where a lot of my own studies were going on and going to these places. And then ultimately, here it is coming out in 2019.
Well, I absolutely love the book, Mark. That Wild Country, when you're hearing this episode, it's going to be available everywhere, hardback and Kindle edition. Is there also going to be an audio version?
Yeah, the
of
audio
it?
Version comes out December 1st as well, and I did narrate that myself as well. So that was a fun process.
I'm going to add that to my Audible queue now. I can imagine how good that's going to be. Mark, this has been so much fun talking. Thank you for the project that you've done and raising awareness about this topic in such a fun and engaging way. If people are just learning about you and want to, dig into all the stuff that you do and maybe follow along for future news and more projects coming from you, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Yeah, I would say a good starting point would be at markkenyon.net. That has links to all the different places that my content is. I run a podcast. I write for a website for a company called themeateater.com. I'm very active on social media, sharing my experiences out in the wild, hunting, fishing, camping. All those things are shared very frequently over on Instagram, and the handle there is Wired to Hunt, which is also the name of my podcast. So people can definitely follow along in those places and see what happens next in the crazy adventures of Mark Kenyon.
Excellent. I'm going to put links to all of that good stuff in the show notes of this episode, as well as to the book That Wild Country, an epic journey through the past, present, and future of America's public lands. Mark, this has been so much fun talking. Let's do it again sometime.
I really appreciate it. I'd love to.
Mather steepled his hands. You asked to join us once. Hedwig leaned forward, eagerly. The appointed. Does that appeal?
Yes.
Do you even know what we do? My grandmother used to say that you control the world. That's not far off. But why? To what end?
I don't know. Power?
Pour me a bourbon. Mather reached into his briefcase and produced a file folder. I want to tell you one story. Have you ever heard of Centralia, Pennsylvania?
No.
He produced a photo for Hedwig's inspection. Spring of 1962. A pretty little town, wasn't it? Whitewash and ticky-tacky, pastel housewives and perfect lawns. A mining community, mostly. Coal. He turned over a second photo. A lovely young woman.
There was a single witch in Centralia named Anna Lively.
Anna had a green thumb. She could make her garden grow, whisper to a flower, and send it shooting from the ground like that. Just lovely. But she was discovered. That spring, a boy named Bobby Avery received a Bell and Howell Zoomatic movie camera for his 11th birthday. Bobby amused himself by filming his neighbors, sometimes without their knowledge, through windows and over garden fences. 12 seconds of film. Just a girl and her garden patch and one swiftly blooming rose. It killed the town. Bobby showed it to his friends. Children believe readily. Bobby was the first to die. Parents looked into it, watched the film themselves, and they began to die. Anna disappeared. Perhaps they attacked her. Perhaps she escaped. But even in her absence, knowledge of a true witch was running wild through the population. as if Anna had beckoned it herself to grow verdant and spread.
The great curse had killed 64 Centralians
by the 1st of June. The footage was offered to a national news organization. That was the precipice. It might have been shown in prime time, between Leave It to Beaver and My Three Sons. We came very close to another worldwide calamity, but we were fortunate. One of our own was in place at the network. He alerted his superiors, and they ended the situation. Do you know how?
I'm afraid to ask.
Mather laid down another photo.
This is Centralia today.
It was an aerial view of a forest. Endless trees and underbrush cut through by lanes of pavement. Just a maze of cracking asphalt, like the foundations of Sodom, ripped bare by the wrath of God. Only a cemetery remained, on a hill overlooking the former town. A white marble angel stood among the graves, grieving for the ruins below, like Lot's wife, turned to salt.
You destroyed the whole town?
Not I. This was well before my time, but yes. Just as you'd cauterize a wound to stop a patient from bleeding to death. We blamed it on an uncontrollable mine fire deep below the earth. We actually set the coal burning in case someone investigated. It burns today. Touch any of those streets and you'll find them hot, the asphalt melting as if the town sat just above perdition. It's not something we're proud of, but it was necessary.
To save the world. Centralia, Pennsylvania, and everyone who'd seen that film had to be sacrificed.
Mather collected the photos. So, that is why the appointed exist, and that is what we do. Still want to join?